Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we are at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking with Michael Hamilton Morgan. His new book is called Arabia in Search of the Golden Ages, and we will be speaking to artist Jennifer Livonian. I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Carol Norton. She's the Associate Director of Wild Earth Guardians. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
It's been a couple of years since you've been coming on this show every once in a while. And right now we have some news that probably most of our listeners don't know about. I didn't know about it, which is that Governor Richardson ordered the banning of a certain kind of animal trap, a trap ban. What's that all about?
You know, it's a huge win for wolves in a time when there's a lot of bad news. And what the governor has done is he's issued an executive order that says trapping will be banned in three counties in the south part of the state, basically wolf country, the Gila. And the kind of trapping he's doing, or the kind of trap he's talking about in the executive order, is a steel leg trap, a bone-crushing, horrible, archaic, cruel trap that gets legs that'll capture an animal by their leg or other body part.
And what was the reason for banning those leg traps?
You know, there's been a wolf reintroduction in the south part of the state.
Now, let's back up for a moment. We're talking about wolves. We're talking about gray wolves, specifically Mexican gray wolves, which are a listed endangered species.
That's correct. In fact, just last week we received good news from Fish and Wildlife that a 90-day finding that says they're going to look at declaring them a specific subspecies, which will give them significantly more protection than they have currently. So they are a gray wolf, but they're the Mexican gray wolf. And in fact, we usually say Mexican wolf just to distinguish them from the gray wolf.
Uh-huh. So these are, they've been reintroduced. They were completely wiped out.
They were wiped out
in
the wild.
Yeah.
In the wild entirely. There were seven left, one female, and from that very small population, they did captive breeding and were able to reintroduce the wolves 12 years ago in Arizona and New Mexico.
One female. If that female had just, you know, caught a cold and died, there would be no more Mexican gray wolves.
Yes, and she wasn't young either. I think she was 7 years old. So
it's like a kind of wolf Adam and Eve story.
It was incredibly precarious and very inspiring.
And so these wolves now are not yet exactly abundant anywhere, but they do live in their habitat in southern New Mexico.
They do, although you're exactly right about it, them not being abundant. In fact, they expected well over 100 by now, and every year for the last 5 years, there's actually been fewer. So last year, they do the count in January, there were 52. This year, only 42.
Oh, boy. So what is keeping their numbers down?
You know, the Gila is a place where there's quite a bit of conflict with extractive industry like grazing. And so it's just been a tough...
Wait, extractive industry? I thought that meant pulling minerals out of the ground.
Extractive is where, in our mind, extractive is where you're taking something from a public land.
Okay, so there's a lot of grazing there.
There is a lot of grazing in the Gila, yes.
And so the incompatibility between grazing and wolves.
It doesn't have to be as difficult as it is in the Gila. It would be best if there were no grazing, but even if there is grazing, there are ways to manage grazing in a way that reduces the conflict. Currently, there is significant conflict between ranching and wolf reintroduction in the Gila.
And what is the nature of that conflict? Are the wolves eating the cattle?
They do. So if you have cattle on the land all the time and you don't remove dead cattle and you don't have a single birthing season and a number of other management, grazing management regulations in place or requirements in place, then there are cattle everywhere who may or may not have babies any time of the year, and wolves will eat one, and once they eat one, they kind of get that they're easier than elk, and they begin to eat cattle.
One of the things that I found interesting is, in the language of the enactment of this trap ban, one of the reasons given for doing it was that when a wolf is caught in a trap and it's leg is injured or its feet are injured or anything like that, they're less likely to hunt wild game like elk because domestic cattle are easier to catch.
That's exactly right. There's a pack in the Gila, the Middle Fork pack, which I find unbelievably inspiring and somewhat tragic. Both the alpha male and the alpha female are three-legged. One was caught in a trap, the other was shot, and they are still managing to have pups each year. It's not easy, but they are doing it. They are one pack that has predated on cattle.
And so when that happens, are there programs to compensate the ranchers?
There are programs to compensate the ranchers. There's a state-run fund, although I don't know that it's actually been funded, if there's any money in it, but there is a fund that is run by environmentalists that also can reimburse ranchers who lose cattle.
So how big of a problem is this loss? In other words, are people losing half of their cattle, 1% of their cattle? I mean, what's going on?
West-wide, it's less than 1%, but I don't think it's so much about the loss of money. It's really the principle of the thing. And for ranchers, they've grown up believing that wolves are their monsters. It's part of their culture, and it's very difficult to change something that has been culturally ingrained that way for generations.
We're talking to Carol Norton of Wild Earth Guardians. Nevertheless, this ban on steel leg traps has been enacted as of the end of July. And so how does that get enforced? Who is setting them?
Great question. So the ban is on both commercial and recreational trappers. Trappers are going after mostly bobcats. So you can get anywhere from $400 to $1,000 for a bobcat pelt. It's actually it's pretty lucrative. Over 20,000 bobcats have been trapped.
Is that legal?
It is legal, or has been up until this trap ban.
Uh-huh.
And so 20,000 bobcats trapped in the last 5-10 years, and which to me is just a stunning number.
That's a lot of bobcats I don't know how many, what's the population of bobcats in a place like New Mexico?
I don't think we even know, which is problematic. And so there's that. The second problem, another problem, is that it captures not just bobcats. So people are trapping also for coyotes as predator control. They're also trapping, the traps also get everything from fox to wolves to bear to horses to dogs. Our own people's dogs, when they're walking on public lands, can be caught in a steel leg trap.
Does that happen often?
It happens. The people who live down there generally know how to release them, and so that's just part of their life. That's something that they want to know because it can happen. And good news is that there's usually the dogs are with their humans. But when another animal is caught in one of these traps, it can be horrifying. They only have to be checked every 24 hours. It's not entirely clear that they do check them every 24 hours. An animal will chew off its leg before it will spend the night. It's a horrifying death. It's if they are left there and they don't get themselves out. They dehydrate. They suffer. It's the more we find out about how it works, the more just horrifying I think it is.
Some of these traps, as you said, are recreational traps, and some of them are government traps.
The government does trap. The ban is commercial and recreational trapping. So people who are getting them for pelts, and then people who are trapping recreationally. I'm not sure exactly what that is. And then the government also has traps. So if, for instance, a wolf needs to be brought out of the wild, and I use that word need loosely because we don't believe that a wolf would ever need to be taken out of the wild, then the government could use a trap. I don't think it's their first choice, but they could.
And so back to this question, how is it being enforced?
It's a great question. So it is a state regulation. It'll be approved at the Game and Fish Commission August 28th, and then it'll be up to the state to enforce it.
And who in the state, like what department is responsible for that kind of thing?
It's Game and Fish. It's a state agency that owns regulating the hunting and other wild animal management issues.
And when it's their mandate to, for example, enforce a trap ban, are the people, I would think it's that kind of enforcement is highly dependent on whether the workers really believe in it.
You know, it's an excellent question. And the good news is that there are a lot of great people on the ground. It'll be interesting to see if the ban, if the executive order is in fact encoded as regulation on August 28th. If it is, then I think we can say that they are bought in and willing to do what needs to be done.
What is the function of wolves in their ecosystems?
Wolves have a very important role in the ecosystem. So they're what's called a top level predator or carnivore, and they actually create something that biologists call a trophic cascade. So very simply, wolves chase elk. Elk stop hanging around in riparian areas. Trees are no longer eaten down to a nub in the along the river. They grow. They create shade. Shade cools the water, allows more oxygen to be taken up by the water. You get better fish populations. Insects become part of the cycle. And so what happens is this trophic cascade. The top-level predator actually creates changes throughout the entire ecosystem. And you see that in many ecosystems.
This is something that's very important to understand. And there's so many different stories like this in ecosystem biology, which is that you don't think wolves make the trout run in the river. But ultimately, it works that way.
Isn't that great? The web of life?
I know.
I mean, hopefully it makes us stop and think before we do something, because you just don't know.
Well, I think one of the things that is very important for people to think about, and it's something that we can all contemplate in different ways, is the effect of one action on an entire system. First of all, we never know what it is, even when we think we do, and Lord knows that the last century was filled with unintended consequences of the highest order on the natural level. But, I mean, wolves make trees grow on the river.
It's amazing, and now we have the documentation to actually show it. So I think from that we can extrapolate a lot.
So you mentioned a couple of minutes ago that something was happening on the 28th of August. What was that?
That's right. The August 28th is a Saturday, and the Game and Fish Commission will be meeting all day, 9 to 5, I believe. They review several regulations that impact wildlife management in the state, and one of the things they'll do is incorporate the ban into the regulations. So assuming they will. Well, they either will or they won't. So they will vote on it.
If people would like to have an impact on that decision, do we citizens have anything to say about it?
Absolutely. Our state agencies are very much beholden to the people. We have every right to comment. So people can do a couple of things. One, they can send their comments in to the Game and Fish Commission, and you can do that by going to our website or emailing me, and we'll pass them on.
WildEarthGuardians.org.
That's correct. And you can also go to the commission. Perhaps even more importantly, we're going to have a Lobo Lover Rally on August 27th.
And so we're not talking about the UNM sports situation.
We are not. Our Mexican wolf is a lobo.
Yes.
And we actually hope that some of the lobos, the UNM lobos, might even attend. Because
there
is a very direct connection between the lobos. There's a reason why that the lobos
the
are our mascot.
The are called the lobos, right?
Exactly.
So there's a lobo-loving fiesta.
That's right, a lobo-lover rally. It's going to be from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Harwood Art Center in Albuquerque. We hope to give the governor a Lobo Lover Award, because the governor has done such a great job taking a leadership role, and we appreciate it so much. It's just been great having Governor Richardson in office for the last 8 years for the wolves. It could be much worse right now.
And that's on this coming Friday.
That's correct. This Friday, 6 to 8 at Harwood Arts Center in Albuquerque.
Carol Norton is with Wild Earth Guardians. Now, let's talk about endangered species in general. There's things happening on the federal level under Obama. There's things happening on the state level under Bush. How are we doing in New Mexico?
You know, we do okay in New Mexico. We have as many endangered species as almost any other state. In fact, I believe we're second or third in the number of species that you find in New Mexico. Arizona is also incredibly diverse, interestingly enough.
I just find it fascinating that these desert states, where it's so hard for anybody to survive, have so many species, such incredible biodiversity.
It's why we love it here.
Yeah.
It's stunning, and we love, I think it's all part of the community, which New Mexicans really recognize. And so endangered species have actually not fared well in the last couple of years. We, as a leftover from the Bush administration, there are a number of species that are that are warranted protections under the Endangered Species Act, but the government does not have the bandwidth to actually protect them. It's called warranted but precluded, and there's a couple hundred species sort of in that limbo.
Just inadequate staffing?
Staffing, funding.
Yeah.
And then there's a number of additional species that are waiting to hear how they, whether they will qualify or not. We've gotten what we call 90-day positive findings. So the initial look by government says, yes, this species does deserve protection, but give us another 12 months and we'll figure it out. And it often takes more than 12 months. And so we're waiting for those. It's something that is actually a problem. It's problematic and needs to be addressed at a systemic level. And that's one of the things that Wild Earth Guardians is really working to do.
Now, you're having a big gala, the annual Guardians Gala, whose theme is endangered species this year, is coming up in September.
That's right. To raise awareness about the situation, we are going to have our Guardian Gala is going to highlight some amazing endangered species, like the lobo, the ocelot, the Gila monster.
What's an ocelot?
An ocelot is a beautiful cat. It is a stunning cat that's still, that you find, funnily enough, in Arizona and Texas, but not so much in New Mexico yet. And that's something we would like to change and find habitat that can be protected for the ocelot here in southern New Mexico.
And so the Guardians Gala, that is a great fun event in which people can learn a great deal and also contribute to the Wild Earth Guardians mission.
That's right. Joel Sartori is going to be our speaker. He's a renowned National Geographic photographer. His talk is amazing. It's phenomenal. He has these incredible pictures. He has these unbelievable stories, and he's really, really good at just marrying the two. So I guarantee that people will have fun. We do want to raise money. We're looking to raise $100,000 that evening, and that will help us move each of the species on the endangered list process forward.
I think that people who are nature photographers, I swear they're another species from the one that I come from. I mean, being able to have that much patience and that much quiet to wait for animals to do their thing, to take these pictures. We're so used to it because we see images like that all the time on television and National Geographic. But getting first of all, to those places, and then, I mean, you can't tell the ocelot or the fish or the turtle, okay, now move a little to the right. Now, we want you in the sun. Now, don't run away.
It's a skill set that that is remarkable.
It's unimaginable.
Yes, I agree. And Joel, I mean, he's had decades of experience doing it. He's great. We love him.
So, Wild Earth Guardians is on the web at wildearthguardians.org. And how else can they reach you?
They certainly can call us at our office, 505-988-9126. My extension is 1150. And pick up the phone, send us an email. We'd love to hear from you.
Excellent. Carol Norton is the Associate Director of Wild Earth Guardians. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's great, Mary Charlotte.
And we're going to take a break right now. We'll be back in a few minutes. Please stay tuned. I'm very happy to welcome now Michael Hamilton Morgan. He is author of the book Lost History, The Enduring Legacy of Muslim Scientists, Thinkers, and Artists, which we talked about when it came out. What was that? Three years ago. Mm-hmm. And he is author of the new book, Arabia, In Search of the Golden Ages, which actually accompanies the IMAX film, which we'll also be talking about. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Great to be back.
It's good to have you back. Now, Arabia in Search of the Golden Ages is a very richly illustrated book. Are the illustrations, or is the photography in here from the IMAX film?
At least 50% of the photos are outtakes from the film. And then some was also original photography, and then we also have some stock photos in there, too.
So what was your role in the making of this film?
I was an advisor to the script. I was a content advisor. Greg McGillivray, who I consider to be the, you know, godfather of American IMAX filmmaking, came to me. He heard me speaking about Lost History 3 years ago, and he said he was working on a project in the Arab world, and would I join up with him? And I hesitated initially because I don't consider myself an expert on Saudi Arabia. I've never lived there. I've been there many times, but I decided to go ahead with it because I felt like it fit in with my own personal mission of trying to build bridges to that part of the world.
And so here you are with this book, which is, you could call it a sort of coffee table sized book with these gorgeous, big, interesting photographs. So how did you decide to actually put this together? Was it to accompany the film?
Right. Well, initially we were going to have me follow the film crew and in part do a narrative of the making of the film. But the film was so difficult to make. It was the hardest film that Greg has ever made. And Greg did Everest at 29,000 feet with people freezing to death and falling off cliffs. He said
this
Arabia was three times harder.
Why?
It was culturally and politically harder. Saudi is not a film center. There is no film culture there. You can't go to a movie in Saudi Arabia. You can watch a DVD at home, but there are no public theaters because the mutawin, the religious police, are afraid that men and women are going to do bad things in the dark. So they don't have theaters. So there was no culture to even work with there. There's no infrastructure. Everything had to be approved by the king. Went all the way up to the king and would sit on his desk for 3 months. The king's very busy.
Yeah.
He's got to run the country. So this was a tiny little thing on his radar screen, and it was just... So what I did was...
How did they accomplish all of that?
It's a long story, but what we decided to do was I would do my own individual narrative based on my travels, and then when possible, intersect with the film. But we kind of went our separate ways because they sat there at one point 4 months waiting for permission to go to Mecca. They waited 4 months.
Yeah.
And it's just really expensive and a royal
pain. Have a film crew sitting in an expensive country.
Yeah.
So you decided to go your own way. So yeah. Tell us about your process.
Well, I have my own contacts there. And, for example, the king invited me to he has a ranch outside Riyadh. And he has an annual festival of Saudiness. It's called Jenadriya. And it's really, I don't know how to describe it, but it's when Saudis get together and celebrate being Saudis. And it's very insular and closed. I was invited to that. I was the only American there. There were, I think, about 1 million people come. The only other American I encountered was the king's helicopter pilot, a former Air Force guy. Everybody else was from the Middle East, from Muslim countries. And so... I mean, for this festival, I was sitting as close to the king as we are to the fellow at the next table. And so I got to watch this very powerful and enigmatic man up close. I met him briefly, chatted through interpreters, but...
Did you tell him your friends needed permits?
No. I didn't want to get in trouble.
Right.
But, and we were in that, it was a bulletproof observation area. That you've seen it before when Obama went to Saudi, he was in that same section on the ranch and George Bush before him. And we watched this festival going on. It was like a Las Vegas Cirque du Soleil quality celebration of Saudi history. The glass is about 3 inches thick. And what it turned into, it really was a pep rally for the king. I've never seen anything like that. A 30-minute chanting and dancing, Abdullah, it's King Abdullah, of course. This went on for 30 minutes. And finally he stood up and started doing a sort of a little tribal dance. It's very, very, very unusual. And I felt privileged to see it. I also had to have people help me interpret what was going on.
Right, right. So the book is called In Search of the Golden Ages. How many golden ages are we talking about?
We're talking about two previous ones. One that hardly anyone knows about, the Nabataean era. This was a spice trading culture that existed in Arabia 2,000 years ago. And it was sort of a linking point between India and points east and the Roman Empire, and it went through Arabia. Nobody knows about this. And this was a rich and very intriguing culture, and it created these beautiful architectural ruins, some of which we've seen in films like Raiders of the Lost Ark, those ruins at Petra and Jordan. That's all part of the Nabataean culture. Same quality ruins in Saudi, but because Saudi does not welcome casual tourism, nobody knows about them. They're just now being opened up. That's the first golden age. The second is, of course, the birth of Islamic civilization with the life of Prophet Muhammad in the 7th century, and then the sweeping out of the Arab armies across all of the Middle East and North Africa into Spain and into Central Asia and North India. That's the second golden age. What we were trying to determine is if the current era of wealth and development in Saudi Arabia qualifies as a golden age. And I think we can say a cautious yes, but there are many things yet to be resolved in that story.
What is yet to be resolved? What do you mean?
Well, what we're talking about right now is one of the most rapid entries of a tribal nomadic culture into 21st century civilization on the globe. I mean, you can find other comparable cases, I suppose, in maybe Southeast Asia, maybe Malaysia, China, and then Saudi. Saudi really wakes up in 1938. That's when they discover oil there. Until then, it's a nomadic, harshly dry, hot, godforsaken place, not a center of world culture, really, for a long time, not since the fall of the Arab Caliphate. And they vault into, you know, they're a superpower now. They're a superpower on energy. They're the world's largest crude oil reserves. And they're also a superpower in religion because they have huge influence over 1.4 billion Muslims in the world. So they're a big deal. And they came into this reluctantly. But they, considering how far they've had to come, I mean, it's really a glass half full or half empty situation. We focus on the critique of, you know, women's rights and political repression and conservatism and so on. And when you look at it from their standpoint, they've come from living in tents and little mud houses to, you know, an energy superpower in 70 years.
What did you see in terms of women's rights or lack thereof?
We could spend some time on that. I interact primarily with upper-class, internationalized Saudi women. They have no constraints to speak of. I mean, they can't go out on the street and wear a bikini, but within the privacy of their own homes and when they travel, they can do whatever they want. Take, for example, Muna Abu Suleiman. She works for Prince Al-Walid, who is a big broadcasting and investor investment group. She dresses like somebody from a Medici court. She's divorced. She leads an independent life. She can say whatever she wants.
Somebody from a Medici court?
Well, I say, yeah, that the way she dresses, you know, Saudi women do have to observe, you have to cover your hair, and you can't show much leg, arm, this sort of stuff.
Right.
And she doesn't cover her face, but she wears these beautiful designer things. I don't know who cooks them up for her, but they meet the dress code, and yet they are, you know, world-class fashion statements. So you have people like that. She's very outspoken. She doesn't have to be escorted by a man. She does whatever she wants. And then lots of other people that I interact with on down the socioeconomic ladder. But when you get into middle class and below, women are almost invisible. once they're married or once they're of a certain age, they have to be veiled. They can't officially talk to unrelated men without another family member present. They can fly an airplane. Listen to this. They can fly an airplane, but they cannot drive their car to the airport.
Right.
You know, this kind of contradiction. And so my interaction with the real, you know, silent majority of Saudi women is almost non-existent.
Right. So you don't... You can't comment on that because you were not able to do the research.
I mean, I'm aware of the things that are... While I was there last November, I believe it was, a case came out. A 78-year-old woman who had a stepson went to meet the stepson and his friend. The stepson was about 22 and the friend was 23. The mutawin confronted them. Accused her of being an adulteress for talking to an unrelated man. That the religious police ruled that her stepson was not a relative, therefore she was engaged in adulterous conversation, and she was sentenced to be lashed. Okay, she's 78. And this is just so... I mean, they have these contradictions. The upper-class international Saudi women doing whatever... holding jobs, flying around the world, and so on.
But and a 78-year-old lady being lashed for talking
right.
to her stepson?
The king had to intervene.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And she wasn't lashed, but right. it had to go all the way to the king, as usual. You know?
Right. We're talking to Michael Hamilton Morgan. His book is called Arabia, In Search of the Golden Ages. Now, the book is called Arabia, not Saudi Arabia.
Right.
There's other... countries, obviously, on the Arabian Peninsula.
That's right. As you go around the peninsula, starting up, I mean, I don't think Kuwait is technically part of the peninsula, but then you come down to Saudi, then you have Qatar, you have Bahrain, you have United Arab Emirates, you have, which are seven emirates within one country, then you have Oman, then you have Yemen, which used to be two countries. It's now an uneasy union of one. And then coming up the other side, I don't know whether you consider Jordan, piece of Jordan in the Arabian Peninsula or not, but it joined Saudi Arabia.
So, right.
Yeah.
Now, did these do any of these countries fall under the purview of your book?
They do, more in the historical sense, because the spice trade came out of Yemen and Oman. In a way, you could say that Yemen is the cultural... ideal or source of Arab sensibility, and that cuts many ways, but Yemen has always been disproportionately influential in the rest of Arabia. Yemen is wetter, it joins the Indian Ocean, a trading place, a lot of interaction with Africa and India and points east, and even today the bin Laden family is from Yemen. So they're very influential in the rest of the Arab world.
We talked to you on this program about your book, Lost History, several years ago. And apparently, I mean, you know, the book had its place here in the United States, but apparently it was really a big hit in the Arab world. And you did a lot of traveling around this book.
That's right. We were very surprised. The publisher of that was National Geographic and Random House. We were focused on the U.S. market, but what we weren't prepared for was the reception in the Arab and broader Muslim world. The book's now gone into, I think, 10 languages, even in the Far East, Japanese, Korean. But the Arab reaction was the biggest surprise. I was just showered with, I mean, the president of Egypt, President Mubarak, gave me his presidential medal for arts and sciences, and I've been invited to meet any number of rulers and leaders, and I get to have direct interaction with them, which was a real surprise. It also shows, I think, the hunger over there to hear an American saying something positive about them and their contribution, because it's all negative right now. It's all bad.
Yeah. Well, I think, as we talked about when you were last here, one of the goals that you had was to start addressing some of the real misconceptions that Americans have about the Muslim world, about Arabic-speaking people, and so on. What are some of those misconceptions?
Well, the misconceptions that we have on this side of the world is that this culture and this faith are universally hostile, violent, aggressive, anti-intellectual, anti-women, anti-liberal, anti-democracy, anti-everything that's part of our world, that it's something in total opposition to who we are.
And as you write in this book, you have a situation that you noticed in Saudi Arabia, which was a lot of liberal people on the coast and then more conservatives right. in the heartland.
It's not like the U.S.
familiar.
Because it's just not a uniform culture. Saudi Arabia has only been a unified country since 1922. And these different regions have their own characters. The West on the Red Sea is really connected to Egypt and to the Mediterranean and to Africa. And then the East is really hooked up with Iran because it's only 70 miles across the water to Iran. So there's a lot of Persian influence over there. So those two sides they're just more open. They always were. Women are freer. They're not covered up like they are. But now Riyadh in the central part, that's the Bedouin, that's the heartland. That's where the Saudi family, the family of the Al-Sauds and the Wahhabi religious group, that's where they come from.
And so how do all of these groups interact with each other? I mean, is there anything that you saw that resembles kind of political dialogue?
Well, what it is a very carefully crafted series of trade-offs and coalitions, kind of a tribal deals in a way. The Saudi royal family is really good at patching things together with different groups, both within the country and internationally. They've learned how to do that. They make deals. They make trades. You get this, I get that. And so with these different concessions, always done quietly behind closed doors, everybody gets a piece of the pie or some sort of a satisfaction, and so it holds together that way.
One of the things that I think is important to talk about also is what was the point of view on the United States of the people that you met while you were doing research for this book?
It was almost moving to meet so many people in this place that we consider to be so alien and in some ways hostile to us, to find so many people who studied here, who have friends here, who've traveled here or whatever, who have a connection, and they've lost it because of the last 8 years. I mean, I describe an event where the king has a big celebration. I'm the only American there. I'm totally alone, and I don't know what I'm doing. And all of a sudden, people come up, and they want to have their picture taken with me. They don't
right.
know who I am.
Right.
They just know I'm an American. And they start asking me, do you know Joe Blow in Milwaukee and all that? And I say, no, I don't. And they say, oh, I've lost touch. And it was sad because I realized, I mean, we helped build that country. Americans don't realize that. We have more influence in that country than any other Middle Eastern place than Israel, I would say. It's just all over the way the cities were laid out, how the government was set up, the educational system and so on was American. The Saudis came to President Roosevelt and they said, teach us how to be modern.
Right.
You know, and that's one of the reasons.
For better or worse.
I mean,
with all the, you know, you show these sort of skyscraper cell phone culture
right?
and presumably all the ills, physical
right.
and spiritual, that arise from that.
Well, that's one of the reasons that Al-Qaeda has focused on the U.S.-Saudi relationship to try and break it up, because they realized how strong it was, despite this huge cultural and religious difference. And I was amazed to see how much of it still survives. In terms of hostility, I know a young advertising executive, and I quote him in the book, I don't name him, but he confessed that on 9/11, he felt like some justice was done, because
yeah.
he empathized with the Palestinians, just like most Arabs. They see it from that frame. And he said, I felt like America needed to feel some pain like we feel. Now, when I've expressed it to some of my American friends in New York, I thought I was going to have my head blown off. But
there are Americans who feel that way, too, who understand
well,
that point of view.
There are some. It's hard right now with this mosque argument in New York. But
it's so ridiculous. I can't even, don't even go there.
But he said, that's the way I felt then. He said, over the last 8-9 years, I've realized that this kind of, you know, violent tit-for-tat, it goes nowhere. It just kills people. It does not resolve anything. And so he is, he's hoping that, you know, he's very much pro-Obama and so on. He's hoping that these nonviolent methods of dealing with this cultural difference can succeed, because he doesn't want to let his children grow up in a horrible mess.
We're talking to Michael Hamilton Morgan. The book is called Arabia in Search of the Golden Ages, and we started out talking about the IMAX movie that was being made, right, that you were consulting on, and many of whose images appear in this book. Where is this movie being shown in the United States? Unfortunately, it's not at the IMAX theater in Albuquerque, which is too bad.
Yeah. It is in Denver, as far as I know right now, and it's in at least 20 other locales, primarily big cities, New York, Atlanta, and so on.
And the hope of this movie is to basically show Americans that, hey, we're all people.
Yeah, it's just really, it's not trying to cover up the dark side of Saudi Arabia, because there is one, just like there's a dark side to almost everywhere. But what it's trying to do is show that these are human beings, and they're not outside the pale of human experience, and they developed along a very different line, and just to open, because, you know, it's been very closed. Unless you're a Muslim, you're not, or unless you work for an oil company, you're not going to go there. And so our understanding of that place is created by headlines and the latest terrible thing or terrorist issue or something, and that defines it for us. Well, you know, I've been there many times. I walk around. I've never seen anybody being beheaded or lashed. I've never seen it. All the worst thing I can say about it is that it's incredibly hot, and it can be very boring at times, because the streetscape doesn't have the spice of, say, you know, a Western city, because there's just a lot of things that can't go on. It's all men walking around. You don't see very many. You don't see any Saudi women, really, except zooming past in a chauffeur-driven car or something. It's just sometimes stultifying, but it doesn't feel like an evil place or whatever.
Well, Michael Hamilton Morgan, you will be speaking this coming Saturday, the 28th of August, at 2 o'clock at Garcia Street Books, and people will be able to hear you and get a hold of a copy of this book.
Good. I look forward to having people there.
Good. Well, it's been great to have you on the air again, and thanks for being on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
I'm very happy now to welcome Jennifer Livonian. She is an artist, and she will be speaking tonight at Tipton Hall at the College of Santa Fe for the Santa Fe Art Institute. It is part of their 2010 season of visiting artists and scholars called Elemental, Earth, Air, Fire, and Water. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me, Mary Charlotte.
So you are a painter and an animator. I guess you started out as a painter and then got into animation and really combined the two. How did that process happen of starting to do animation?
Well, I studied painting in undergrad, and in the grad school I went to get my MFA in painting. And that first year I was in graduate school at RISD, the Rowan School of Design. There's a special winter session that's 6 weeks long. And faculty encourages students to take something outside of their discipline. So I picked animation. And as soon as we got to the technique called cut paper animation, I was hooked. And it's been the focus of my studio ever since for the past 5 years.
What is cut paper animation?
Well, the way I do it is pretty low tech and do it yourself, but for each animation, I make hundreds of watercolor paintings with really detailed backgrounds and puppets, and then I animate it using a copy stand, and I will move a puppet across the background, take a picture, move it a little bit more, take another picture, and then I take all those digital photographs, import them into my computer, and edit them.
So it's, in a way, I mean, it's the way people did animation a long time ago, except the final stage happens on the computer.
Exactly, exactly.
And so what is the effect like? I mean, it's not like cell animation where you have the effect of people talking and their mouths moving.
Right. I mean, yeah, sometimes I do that. It's a little bit wonkier. The movement could be smoother if I had the patience to do it, but I kind of definitely have a choppy aesthetic.
So what are some of the subjects and themes that come into your work?
Well, I mean, just generally speaking, I think in most of the work, I try to look at everyday life in today's culture, and the setting is usually a really mundane place, a place that you've probably been to in the past week, like I said, one in a Starbucks, another one in a gourmet grocery store. I just did one that was set at a bridal shower. And I keep returning to the idea of monotony in daily life and the desire and longing that people have to overcome it. So a lot of my characters are often bored, and they try to change their situation by making some sort of meaningful connection with another person or a place or in the case of the church service animation that I did with a higher power.
Very interesting. So are you going to be showing some of the animations at the lecture tonight?
I am. Mm-hmm. I think I'm going to show about 5 or 6 short animations. They're all under 8 minutes long, mm-hmm. and talking about them.
Now, is there, shall we say, market for animations at this point in history?
A market? Like in the fine arts
Yeah.
world?
Yeah, in the fine arts world, or I mean, how do they get shown?
Well, it's interesting because there are a lot of contemporary artists making short animations, and it's funny because they sort of straddle both like the fine art gallery world and the film festival world. But in my case, I've been selling them in small editions, and then each one comes with a hand painted cover.
A small edition, what would it be, a DVD?
Yeah, a DVD and an edition of 50, and then each one comes with an original hand-painted cover.
Hey, if I'm remembering, I used to follow animation more than I do now, and Canada seemed to have the world sort of leadership on animation because they funded it. Is it still that way?
Yeah, I think the National Film Board of Canada, yeah, I think you're completely right, and they had residencies, and they do a lot of funding. I don't think we have anything like that in the U.S., unfortunately.
So what is the state of fine art animation today? Where do you draw your inspiration from in terms of animation?
In terms of other animators? Well,
yeah.
I really love the work of Yuri Norstein, who's a Russian animator. He did especially his animation Tale of Tales. I think it was made in 1979 or 1980. And if you're interested in seeing it, I think the whole thing is on YouTube. So there are plenty of people making animation. Probably the most well-known contemporary artist who's making animation is William Kentridge, who is from South Africa. And he's really successful.
Now, do you still continue to do still, I guess you would call it, still watercolors?
You know, not too much. I've really been focusing on the animations. I mean, I make plenty of paintings, and so I kind of treat them more like props. So we have been showing them alongside the animations when I've had shows, and sometimes I'll reassemble all the props and make a collage out of them and try to make something new with them that doesn't necessarily relate to the narrative of the animation. But I'm still kind of figuring that out as I go.
Now, will you be teaching a workshop when you're in Santa Fe?
No, I won't. Mm-mm.
So you will be lecturing tonight. We're talking to Jennifer Livonian, and her lecture is at 6 o'clock tonight. It's part of the Santa Fe Art Institute's ongoing series, Elemental Earth, Air, Fire, Water. It's at Tipton Hall. For more information, people can call 505-424-5050. They can also go to sfai.org. Jennifer, thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Oh, thank you so much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.